You may be seated. Prayer concerns? Okay, thank you guys. We have rookie ushers today, so yeah, sir, they're filling in. Our other ushers had to cook at the picnic, so yeah. I'm here. We're still kind of partway down our series during Lent. Been using this image to look at the places where we find Jesus, some of the scenes of the gospel accounts of his life, that somehow where he is communicates a great deal about who he is. And I hope who we are to be, that where we find Jesus is where you and I are called to be in one way or another along our only faith journey. So where we find him informs us, if we're followers of him, logically, that we would go where he leads us. And first sermon, the traditional place that we find Jesus is in the wilderness. Wilderness, contemplating his own calling, his own mission and ministry, what kind of Savior he would be, facing the temptations to be a lesser kind of Savior than the one that humanity needed. It teaches us that Jesus was thoughtful and prepared, and he was renewed by being off with God in times of solitude, but not really alone. So that you and I are invited to do that same kind of thing, to be renewed, to do a time of preparation for the important parts of our lives and what is our life about and not and so forth. And next Sunday, remember, we looked at Jesus was among the crowds. He went to where the people are. Jesus was not one of these fools that we see. You know, when we think about a holy man, sometimes the scenario is a holy man is on a mountain and people wait in line to see the holy man. Jesus went to where people are. He served where their brokenness was, where their hurts were, where their hunger was. He went to the people the way you and I are called to go to all who need him. And last Sunday we kind of did an early precursor to Palm Sunday about the triumphant entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem. You know, and his rock star status, but going on a donkey. And what did that say? And who was that speaking to? And what was the message there? And what is our message? And what do we believe about humility and dignity and so forth? And are we going where he leads us in that way? And today we find him at a very different kind of place, but still very authentic to who he was. And I had trouble with the title today. And Saturday Night Live used to have this skit that they would do back in the 70s. It was like first draft theater. It was all the skits that they wrote with really bad ideas that they didn't get corrected. So the title of this message was going to be Jesus Between the Stoners and the Prostitutes. And I thought, ooh, I don't think that's probably, it's kind of true, but I don't think it's sending the message that we need to send. So I rethought that, but I really didn't like what I have. If I was renaming it, it would be Jesus Between the Accused and the Accusers. I think that gets more at it. I told my friend Denny, who's a pastor at First Church in Phoenix, about this. Also came from Nebraska, and he has trouble, he said, with titles too. So what he does is he doesn't put a title on his message. But what he does is he invites at the end of his message for the congregation to write their own title, and then they submit it. And then the next week he announces the winner of last week's sermon. Yeah. So, but this last week he preached on the parable that Jesus had about the tree that wouldn't bear fruit, and when the farmer puts manure in it. So that next week he said there will be no winner to the sermon title this week. Every one of them is I'm not allowed to say out loud. So that tells you something about his congregation. But this is where we find Jesus, I think. Something profound about where we find him today. Between the accusers and the accused. Between those who have power and authority and those who do not. Between the poor and those with wealth. Between those with status and those without. And that's what's represented in all this. And, of course, the story is that that's the Pharisees. Again, those who are the elite in power and the wealthy, even though they're of the religious community there. And they're trying to trap him, as they always are. And And Jesus, he'll have none of it. And so they catch him, trying to catch him to be gracious, which would go against the law if he would step in and say, no, you cannot stone this woman, as for the law says. But Jesus always was able to escape that, as he does here. But, you know, looking back, it's kind of a natural thing. If we looked back the history of the Bible, if we looked at it as a history of humanity, if we wanted to take the God stuff out of it, the divinity out of it, it might well be the history of us, which says to the world that humanity, we are not very good at being good, are we? We don't seem to be capable to stay on the right track very long. It's a history of a sad parade of people who can never keep the covenant. And the covenants are always broken, and it's never God that breaks them. And God has to step in God's redemptive ways and forgive us and renew us. And yet we don't get that lesson. We do well for a while, it seems, but then we either revert into one or two camps. One, we go back to old habits, which got us in the mess in the first place. Or we found that we could be righteous. But then righteous descended into self-righteousness and subjugating it one over another and missing the whole view, the whole reason why God gave us the faith in the first place. Here's something that the Dalai Lama wrote about religion. That the very purpose of religion is to control yourself, not criticize others. That rather we must criticize ourselves. And in this season of questioning, he who was the leader of the Buddhist asked these questions. How much am I doing about my anger, about my attachment? Remember, for Buddhists, attachment is the reason we're in this whole mess anyway. We're so attached to ourselves and our own life and all of that that we can't see beyond it or move beyond it, our own desires. So what are we doing about that? About my hatred, about my pride, and about my jealousy. Those are not just good questions for a Buddhist. Those are good questions for a Christian, for anybody who wants to somehow elevate themselves in this life through whatever faith that they have, the faith that's life-affirming, does these things. And the Dalai Lama goes on to say that these are the things that we must check in daily life, to check ourselves every day. For Christians, we seek to take it a step forward, that we're not just about checking ourselves and where we are, but about our Lord and where he goes, and are we following him? I was thinking about this this message, and I was thinking about my trouble with the title about Jesus and the stoners. You know, there is a what is it? DN? There's a stoner Jesus if you, on the internet, which is very interesting and weird. Yeah, it's a what?
It's called the bro Jesus.
The bro Jesus. Yes, and. But it kind of gets you. There's also, doing a little research, there's saints. There are patron saints for all kinds of causes and people who don't have one. And that kind of says something. It's weird, but it also says something about the need that people have for Jesus. But I was thinking about one of my colleagues back in Nebraska at the church that I served in Omaha. The pastor that had served before me, he got in trouble. He and the associate pastor, they sang at a church service. They sang a song together. They both sang and played guitar. I know it. You're so cheated. You got this pastor that can't do either of those things. But they sang this song by Bob Dylan. And maybe you know this song, Rainy Day Woman number 12, or the title that is more, Everybody Must Get Stoned. They sang that song on Sunday morning to the church, and they got in trouble for it. And I blame Bob Dylan, because if you could understand anything that he sang, you might be able to hear the lyrics and know that it wasn't so much about getting stoned with pot, but although, you know, it's Bob Dylan, it is the 60s, that was kind of in there, and he was known for his cryptic kind of metaphoric journeys that he took. And but it's deeper than that. It's richer than that. It's something that gets it at some kind of human trial that we find ourselves through history. And it's about, really, stoning is about the subjugation of the powerful using the law to keep folks with lesser power and lesser status and lesser wealth down. That the stones are actually referred to as the tablets of stone. That it's the stone then has become the law that was a gift of God that was used by the powerful to keep others down. And he talks about, and you can hear that, and you can hear what's going on in the civil rights, if you can put yourself back in the place when you hear that, they'll stone you when you're trying to keep your seat. Think about Rosa Parks. They'll stone you when you're walking in the street. About the people who got arrested because they were in the wrong part of town. They stone you when you're walking to the door. Remember the students that broke the segregation line with the National Guard on either side of them? But it would not feel so all alone. They'll stone you when you're walking on the floor. And everybody must get stoned. They stone you when you're young and able. They stone you then and they'll say good luck. They'll stone you when you're at the breakfast table and on. And it would not be so all alone. So it's something about the solidarity of people who have been victimized by the powerful. And that if all the people were victims of that, there would be no one who was the powerful. That there was a solidarity in sharing together our hurt and our vulnerability. And that's something I'm sure there's much more in that as well. But that's a deeper, richer song. But he, the pastor that shared that, he didn't say any of that. Okay, so he had a special meeting, which we call a come to Jesus meeting with the district superintendent. And yes, believe me, you don't want to go to those meetings as well. But anyway, that's a little bit that I think of in the passage and around that. The story we remember, you know, if we heard it before, if we grew up in the church, we've heard this story often. And we know that they're trying to trap him, and they get him, and they bring this woman to him, and they have stones, and they're confronting him that, Lord, what would you do? That here, this woman has broken the law, she has committed adultery, and by rights, she should be put to death. And so people around are gathering stones, and they're waiting for his response. And we remember that Jesus' response, he doesn't fall into their traps. And he doesn't give in to any kind of vindictiveness, even though he just must be angry at them to follow him around, waiting, trying to trip him up. But he knows he has to do something, because condemnation is not his way. And what he understands about the law, that it was not meant to hurt people, it was not meant to condemn people, it was meant to free them, that being faithful was not about the following of the law. It was about being in right relationship. The commandments themselves are all about that. They're all about, if you reduce them, well, Jesus reduced them down to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, to love your neighbor as yourself. If I were to do it, I would say there are 10 laws about don't take things that aren't yours. Don't take what belongs to you. Don't even covet it. Don't even want for it. And don't follow any God that's not your God. And those things together, it was about being in right relationships, and that the relationships were more important than the following the letter of the law. And the people were definitely more important than the law. And so Jesus breaks in this way, and I want you to see the way that he breaks in with them. He breaks in to offer grace, not just for this woman accused of adultery, but for those who accuse her as well. I want you to see that, because I don't think everybody sees that. You know, we want to stand with Jesus and standing for the woman who's accused and never even recognizing that we're a little bit like the accusers. that any of us have ever sought to condemn anyone else, we in our way are picking up stones. But here's how Jesus does it. Well, does it. Well, first off, let me just point out the question that is always begged to be answered in this passage. And many of you who studied this, maybe later in life when you're an adult, asked this question. Where is the guy? Where's he at? The one that she was caught with. Where is that dude, right? Isn't he culpable as well? Isn't he there to stand? Where is he? All right. So that question there, but I want you to go deeper than that. I want you to look at Jesus' response. It's very peculiar. It's very interesting. He kneels down, remember? He stands there in front of her accusers, and he kneels before them. And I brought this up before. I like this interpretation. We don't know what it is he wrote in the dirt. The Bible doesn't say. But I like the interpretation that he standing in front of her accusers, wrote down their own sin. Because he kept writing, remember? Maybe what he wrote was adulterer. Maybe he wrote thief. Maybe he wrote liar. Whatever he wrote, when he stood up and he said, "Let those without sin cast the first stone," what'd they do? They left. And they left in a hurry, right? Exit left. They are out of there. Okay, and then this moment of grace when he says, "Woman, who's here to condemn you? Where are your accusers?" And there's no one. So it's clear he offers her grace. But he also offered it to them. He didn't name out loud their sin. He put it before them so that they could deal with it on their own, so they could wrestle with it, so they could respond to it, so they might begin to consider a different way of being and doing. You see, when I was in seminary, they taught us really some great things, some things that opened my eyes. And one of the things when I was going to seminary was they taught us to read the Bible in terms of what was called liberation theology. And that said primarily that we would read the Bible as God's perspective of having a preferential option for the poor and the weak. And if you read the Bible, well, you can certainly see that. But they also taught us that not only were the weak victimized by this, but the powerful as well. And their attempts to dehumanize this woman, they dehumanized themselves. And so, yes, it's easy for us to not have much mercy for them, but know that they are victims as well. And that Jesus came to offer mercy for both. Grace to both for the possibilities of redemption for all. That grace is for all. If grace is not for all, it is not the grace of Jesus Christ. We best remember that because you and I, we have our own hard places in our hearts. And we like to judge the hardness of hearts of others. But we don't so much like to look inward on our own. We like to rationalize our own. You know, so I start thinking about people in our own time and our own culture for which it is hard to us to extend any grace and forgiveness and opportunity for redemption and new life. So I came up, I asked some help here from girls in the office about, now we've heard the words "Me Too," and we got some faces that we put before. You recognize these faces? Okay, these are all men who were very powerful at one time, wealthy, who used their power, their influence, to subjugate and abuse women. And then they got caught. And it's hard for us to well up any kind of grace for them because they didn't ask for forgiveness until they got caught, all right? And they didn't really think about offering that to those who they had hurt. And so it is very difficult for us to to consider forgiveness, grace, and the possibility of redemption. But if there is no way forward for them, if there's no redemptive possibility for them that we can offer, whose followers are we really? You see, you and I cannot allow the hardness of others' hearts to harden our own, because then we're just as culpable. We're just like them, only we come at it a different place. We have to all be people of grace. We have to offer grace to the people for whom it's easy and the people for whom it's difficult. So you can take those off there, Al. I want us to kind of bring this more personal. So what do we do with these rocks if we're not to throw them? My encouragement would be first that before we consider ever judging someone else, before we offer condemnation, that those are our rocks, that we would look inwardly at our own. We would think, what? There must be some rocks with our name on it somewhere. There must be sin that Jesus might write our sin in the dirt in front of us. We all got some dirt in front of us with a name on it. What is it? We all have that. And if we start there, it gets more difficult to throw those rocks. So what do we do with them? Well, let's do what the ancients did when they gathered rocks. Do something constructive with it. The ancients took the rocks that when they crossed the river to the promised land, they made a way through that river with those rocks. And the Bible mentions several places in which there was a time when they recognized that God did a great thing for them and God's grace happened among them. And they built a little altar there with those rocks. Now, I happened upon these rocks a while ago. These are leftover rocks from a series, apparently, that Billy and Angie did. Anybody remember what these rocks? Anybody remember the sermon? No. All right. So apparently these are not remembering rocks. Right? But what I noticed, they've all got a little cross on them. Right? And I was told that over time, they've used these a couple times. The cross is rubbed off. They had to put them back on. All right? So my encouragement would be today, if you're willing, that you take one of these rocks with you on the way out today. That this rock is not a rock for throwing. It's a rock for keeping. It is a remembering rock, for remembering our own sin, for remembering our own sort of penchant for condemnation and self-righteousness, that if we would do that whenever we are feeling like we want to throw a rock at someone, that we don't. We just hold it. Keep that to remind us of who we are, why we are, and if that cross ever goes off, drop back on there, okay? As a reminder, if you would, that it's not a rock for throwing. You're not allowed to throw these rocks unless you're close to one of those ravens in the parking lot. Then no, don't do that either, although I've been tempted by that, yeah. One of our prisoners tells me that they're sacred. I've never seen that in the Bible, and not reading that part. But that's my encouragement, my friends, when you go today, to take one of these on and hold on to it and let all that that's about hold on to you. And may you never be a person who throws it.